Hello and welcome to The Convex Conversation with me, journalist Helen Prospero. 10 years ago, Dr. Emma Eggin's husband, Flight Lieutenant John Eggin, lost his life while completing a Red Arrows display at Bournemouth Air Festival. John was a fast jet pilot and was coming to the end of his first year in the RAF's world-famous aerobatic team as Red 4. Emma wanted to realise her husband's ambition to help young people who are facing adversity be the best they can be, and founded the John Eggin Trust, known as JET, which has now supported more than 30,000 youngsters. And Emma aims to reach out to more than a million people by 2031. Morning, Emma. How are you?
Morning. I'm really well, thank you.
Well, it's lovely to see you this morning. It really is extraordinary how much of a difference you and JET have made to young people's lives in John's name. Will you tell us a bit about John and what kind of man he was, Emma?
Yeah, of course. So John and I met at university. We both went to Southampton Uni and we're talking 1998 now. So we probably shouldn't have met at uni because he was taking a very different subject to me. I was studying archaeology and John had actually chosen to do environmental science, which also might sound a bit random for someone who was so determined to be a pilot. But I think our paths would never have crossed unless we both joined the University Air Squadron. And this is a true story. I was determined from a young age to discover the secrets of Stonehenge and on a real path to become an archaeologist. And then I watched Top Gun. And I really literally thought, wow, that's another world, you know, the world of flying and aviation. I've not even ever thought of being part of it or whether I could do it, you know, flying. And so it seriously was a light bulb moment that I had watching Top Gun, thinking, well, I'd love to try it. So I joined the University Air Squadron. John had a bursary to be a pilot through the University Air Squadron and the Royal Air Force. And we both learnt to fly together. So that's how I met. And from the very beginning, John was very warm, huge smile, always made you feel comfortable, always made you feel that nothing you said was silly. And especially at the time when the Air Squadron, everyone kind of knew what they wanted to do. And I was, as an archaeologist, kind of felt a little bit out of my comfort zone walking into this squadron with very smart girls and boys in uniform, talking about this world of the Royal Air Force and aviation that I had no knowledge about. So John made me feel from the beginning, as part of that big group of students, that I could belong there and I wasn't the best pilot. And, you know, that encouragement, I think he took through the rest of his life, the encouragement, the warmth, but also he was very focused on what he wanted to do, but also what he knew was possible. And I always admired that.
What did you do with your flying, Emma? Was yours flying for pleasure?
Yeah.
You know, or did you have any ambition to take it to a more professional level?
I'm a strong believer in try as many different things as you can. You're not going to be good at all of them, but in trying lots of different things, you'll find out what you're good at. So that was part of that ethos, really. This was, you know, back in the 90s, it was the Bulldog aeroplane we were flying at the time. You know, it's subsequently been replaced by lots of different aeroplanes, and they now fly the Tutor and the Prefect at that level. But it was amazing, you know, at the age of 19, 20, to be in the pilot seat and to be doing all the checks, taking an aeroplane off, flying it around in a circuit. It was amazing, but it was also very scary, Helen. I'm not going to lie. I was very much out of my comfort zone. And as much as I loved the experience and I absolutely loved the world it opened up for me, being a pilot wasn't my thing. It really wasn't. And also, we flew over the most amazing landscape, you know, down at Boscombe Down and around Salisbury Plain. You've got Stonehenge, you've got all of the amazing earthworks, you've got the barrows, the long barrows. So I also have to admit, I spent a lot of time looking out the window thinking, wow, that's what Stonehenge looks like from the air. So I discovered through doing that, that it wasn't for me, but it did open up this whole new world. But also these values, which we take through now with the trust and epitomised by John, epitomised by the military, hard work, dedication, being the best you can be. And, you know, that's very much what the John Eggin Trust is all about.
What drove John with his flying? Did he know at that stage that he wanted to go all the way to fast jet?
Yes. It's this sort of razor-like focus that he had from the beginning, where his father was an airline pilot. So he'd experienced that world of aviation. He'd seen his father through his training, he'd seen him go away on long haul, he'd been in the jump seat going down route, as John used to say. So that aviation was in his blood through his father. But John actually wanted to go straight into, like, following his dad's footsteps, he wanted to become a commercial pilot. And rather than going to uni, his first idea was to go straight to BA. And he took the exam. This is before I knew him. I believe he took the exam and he failed it on his maths. John was a straight A student. So to fail on maths, this is, I think this was before he knew what he was really wanting to do. That really crushed him in that moment. He really thought, oh goodness, you know, what if I can't do this? So he had a bit of a rethink. He stood back a little bit. And if it wasn't for his gliding instructor, so this is someone he met through his cadet force, who said, don't give up, John. You've got a real talent. You really are outstanding in what I've seen of you. If it wasn't for that one person saying, keep going, don't give up, I don't think John would have progressed. We certainly wouldn't have met at the Air Squadron.
You speak beautifully about how kind and how encouraging he was with you, Emma, but he really cared about people, didn't he?
Yeah, he absolutely did. That's important, isn't it? You know, teamwork and leadership are really core competencies. They're really core life skills. And you can be the best archaeologist or the best pilot on paper, but if you can't support others around you and work together to bring out the best in everyone, not just yourself, I think you're missing something, aren't you? And you're certainly missing a kind of a wider community feel, but also getting the job done. You need a team to get the job done.
You do.
John really was great at those life skills.
The Reds are loved and admired all over the world. Are you able to share just a little bit, Emma, of what happened that dreadful day in Bournemouth, just so we understand what the John Eggin Trust was born out of?
Yeah. So this was, as I said, we met at university. We were both on actually quite a focused career journey. I really did want to go into archaeology in some way. John absolutely wanted to go through the kind of the layers that you have to go through to get to that fast jet ambition. So we left uni. John went to RAF Cranwell for his officer training. I was doing some work in London. Then John went off to RAF Linton-on-Ouse, where he, you know, went through the Tucano, off to Valley. So, you know, this was over a 10-year period. John and I knew each other for 10 years. I was a student at Manchester then. Let me now take you back to sort of 2008. We'd, for the first time in our 10 years together, we were able to kind of be in the same place, because John was all over the country. I was all over the country. So we just started living together. John was on the Harrier at that point. So he'd actually was based near Stamford in a beautiful part of England. I was in London. And then in 2010, he was selected for the Reds. Awesome. He always had ambitions to go and join the Reds, but also he absolutely loved flying the Harrier and was on a deployment through the Harrier. So when the Harrier fleet was disbanded and the opportunity for the Reds came up, he absolutely jumped at it. So of course, I saw him go through the training with the Reds, which is really grueling. And being a first year pilot, we talk about comfort zones. Wow, you know, John had thousands of hours of flying. He'd flown a jump jet Harrier, but then going in a team where you've got to display in formation, you've got to practice and practice and practice. And when you've done that, you practice some more. So interesting hearing him develop as a person and as part of that team. So all through this, I was working in London. So I'd landed my dream job. I was working at the British Museum. I was commuting down to London. He was commuting up to Scampton. And it was actually a really dreadful summer in terms of the weather. It was really rainy and it wasn't the best weather at all. And what that meant was that they do three types of different displays depending on what the weather was. And they hadn't done what we call the full display at all, really, I think, that summer. So I was trying to see John as much as I could displaying. And I was with some of my best friends, actually. And it was a beautiful summer's day, clear skies. And that morning, I remember John being really elated because he knew that they could do this full display for one of the first times in the season. So he was on a high. I was there watching him, and as much as I could get there, you know, can't get there all the time. So he was really happy about that. He was really happy that we had loads of friends at the beach watching him. It was a good day. It's funny, Helen, because if you've got other half in the Air Force, you know what they do. You know how many times they fly. You know there's always a risk. And on that day, I knew there was something wrong when he didn't ring me. So he used to always, like without fail, ring when he landed. And I just remember seeing the display and chatting to my friends and just looking at my watch and thinking, this is a bit odd because I haven't had a call. And it's often reported that his accident happened during the display. It didn't. It happened during they were coming into land. So yeah, it was quite simple, really. I had a feeling there was something wrong. And then I was on the beach chatting, and I then had lots of calls coming into my phone, and they weren't from John. So I knew in the gut feeling there was something up. Got a call to come back to the hotel where we were all staying. was by myself. I wanted to be by myself, actually. I went back and all the other halves there. There's an amazing community around the Reds. And I just remember all the girls being there with that look in their eyes, which meant something bad had happened. And then from then on, the kind of process takes over and the Royal Air Force sort of went through it with me. And that was the day, really.
Very hard, Emma, not, you know, having walked in your shoes to understand how you managed to pick up the pieces.
Well, you know, it's funny, isn't it? Because I'm not a military girl. So you kind of, and I mean that let me explain. So I kind of, you know, John was the guy that was focused and he kind of had all those skills. And I was a quiet one, I guess. I was the one who was into my archaeology and very studious. But at that moment, I kind of became John, and in a really good way. I kind of knew how he would deal with it. And I just thought, I know what to do. And I suppose throughout the charity, that's exactly what I've done. And I've taken those skills and those values and created a charity which in many ways encapsulates those qualities. But look, every young person needs to have that warmth and that guiding hand that says, don't let anyone tell you you can't, you can. If you really believe in yourself, you can. And I suppose I was able, and I'm one of the lucky ones, right? I was able to take that really horrific moment, and so many people go through horrible moments. I'm not alone in that. But I was supported all the way through setting up, and it's blooming hard setting up a charity. I can say that looking back now over the last 10 years. But in that moment, I was supported to take who John was and go large with it. And I've just run with that ever since. And do you know what? I've grown so much and I've learned so much. And as hard as it was and as hard as running a charity is, I know we can do so much more as well.
The current officer commanding of the Red Arrows, David Montenegro, who I know is a great friend and great supporter and trustee of your charity, says that he remembers standing next to you in Bournemouth the day after and you talked about what you were going to do. So tell us what you've done. Tell us about the core work of the extraordinary trust that you set up.
In many ways, it's simple. You know, I saw through John, but also Monty and all of the brilliant individuals I and our young people have access to. All I quite simply said was, we're missing a trick here. Because, for example, you take RAF Valley, you take Scampton, you know, all these amazing bases. Behind the wire, you have expertise that's beyond any expectations. You have the technology, you have the people, you have the resources, which are so inspiring. Yet beyond the wire are areas of real deprivation. You know, young people who, for lots of different reasons, may look up at the sky and the aeroplanes flying and think, that could never be me. So all we need to do is take away the wire, dissolve it, allow young people to have access to these amazing women and men and help them see in themselves what they're good at. So that was the concept, really. Again, that concept of warmth and believing in each other and helping each other. But it was really to say to these amazing bases, please let us have John Aiken Trust young people on these visits and they'll be inspired, but also through our fantastic team of youth workers and trained teachers, we've created syllabus and programs that tie in with the curriculum and enhance the curriculum in many ways to help fill in those gaps for young people who are struggling. So just to paint a picture of our young people with untapped potential who may well have been struggling at school, maybe bullying, or they might have ADHD or something going on that means that academic or normal sitting down at your desk, listening to the teacher all day just isn't working for them. They might may be having trouble at home. So some of our young people are young carers looking after a sick parent. Some of our young people are in care because things have got so tough at home. So these are young people that just haven't had that opportunity to shine or haven't seen in themselves how to shine, but have got bags of potential. So, and teachers have got so much on. There's so much emphasis on academic results that often that grey individual, you know, that young person who is not being naughty, is not standing out in any way, but is just keeping their head down, taking the easy options, and their grades are slowly sliding. When you're 7 to 14, if someone doesn't catch you at that moment when you're starting to disengage, then those grades are going to continue to slide. And the worst case is we see so many young people falling out of education just because that slide doesn't get caught. It goes continue. So we are an early intervention charity that catches young people and makes that difference at a time when they most need it. So when they're taking their GCSE choices or when they're thinking about what can I do when I leave school. And we turn their lives around, and we do that through meeting all those Johns out there, who pilots, the engineers, all those people that can sit down with them in the crew room and say, what are you interested in? And oh my goodness, for a 13-year-old to have someone in a red suit or someone that fixes aeroplanes or someone that loads aeroplanes sitting down next to them and saying, hey, Sally, tell me about you. That makes such a difference. So I always talk about how we use inspiration as a hook. So we have our young people do amazing things. And then after that hook, when that light bulb has been lit, we then work with the schools to support them with their learning. So we provide programs that focus on teamwork, communication, building resilience. And we work with young people on our Blue Skies program over 3 years. So we take them on this journey from being at the cusp of dropping out of school or going that way at age 13. And we make sure that they stay in school and they're still there at 16 and they know what they're good at and they're starting to take those right choices for them.
How do you find these young people who need help and how do they find you?
Again, we work in partnership. Partnership is so important, and through partnership and collaboration, you can do so much more. So right from the beginning, we had a head teacher connected to the trust on our trustees board. We started in Lincolnshire. So I got to know the needs. I got to know who to go to, so the local authority, the schools, and you know the areas, you can see the areas on a map which are lacking opportunities. They're literally red, you know, the red areas. We all know about urban problems associated with urban areas, but also there's a lot of rural isolation, a lot of communities around a lot of the bases where they're suffering a lack of attention for other reasons. There's maybe lack of aspirations and there are, you know, real areas of poverty. So I work with the team to identify those areas and we work with schools. We go and approach schools, but also we have schools coming to us. And because we've been around for 10 years and in 8 different regions, we now have a waiting list of schools who want to work with us in our regions.
Tell us more about the Blue Skies teamwork program and how that works.
So Blue Skies was born in 2012. We worked with a school in Lincolnshire, Priory Witham Academy, and it was our first school and we worked with just 10 young people. It worked. It really worked. The school thought it was brilliant. It filled a gap, and the gap is around those life skills and competencies, the wraparound. So how do you support a young person who is so shy that they can't look you in the eyes, or when you ask them a question, they just can't summon the courage to sort of speak, especially if you're a scary person with a red arrow suit on who, oh my goodness. So we've got to build in that young person the self-belief to be able to have a voice that they are proud of. So we do that by working with our inspirational partners. It's not just the military. You know, we work with an amazing range of corporates. So for example, the Air Traffic NATS, Air Traffic Control Service down south, is one of our major partners. And brilliantly, all of this skills around air traffic, around supporting each other, working as a team, but also how do you control the skies safely? So our young people become an air traffic controller for an afternoon. They do some activities where they learn some of the competencies, such as dealing with lots of different information at the same time, but you've got to make a decision. So quick thinking, decision making. And they do these through some fun games and activities, but they also then see the air traffic control room and they can see everyone working at their desks and, you know, see these aeroplanes flying, flashing through the screen. So it's a real mix of skill building, but real life experience. And that's the thing, they don't, at school you can't get the real life experience because you're in your classroom. Oh my goodness, you take them out of that sphere and you provide them with access. For example, young people have also followed aircraft engineers around an airplane, a Typhoon, and kind of they see the checks they have to do and they see them working on this aircraft, and then you have them back in the classroom and you debrief that. You know, what skills did you see? What sort of aptitudes did you see? You know, the sort of working together, the aptitude, but also the attention to detail. You miss a screw when you're trying to service an aeroplane, that's really bad. So it's one thing sitting in a classroom going through a checklist. It's another thing having a real life experience and then getting beneath the skin so that you don't just learn something, you understand. It's a no-brainer, really. These amazing opportunities that we have for our young people are through our partners saying, we want to support your work. And yes, we'll give you access to our base or our workshop or our factory. And that's where the magic happens.
You're so right about the magic happening. I mean, as a journalist and broadcaster, I'm lucky with all the experiences I've had, and made a film a couple of years ago with the Reds at Scampton, and never tire of going up there and seeing behind the scenes and feeling really lucky to see behind the scenes, and not just the guys in the red suits, but the engineers, and how critical every job is. It's a real privilege, and it's great that you saw that opportunity to get youngsters in. Because every time I go, I learn something new And I feel it motivates me in a massive way. But because you're in your 10th year, Emma, and you're talking about the Blue Skies Teamwork Programme starting in 2012, you must now have absolutely seen the difference JET's made to some people's lives without obviously giving full names. Have you got any examples of how you've taken a youngster a few years ago and seen them go on to do great things because they've been inspired and supported by the charity?
So many examples. And in a way, even though lockdown and the last year's been so tough, it also gave me some time to phone up some of our graduates. We have a fantastic cohort of JET Youth Ambassadors, and I phoned up a couple of them just to see what they were doing and what they were up to. So Bethany, I'll give you an example of Bethany. I phoned Bethany. Bethany is now 22. She was on our programs in Norfolk back in 2014. She was a painfully shy, beautiful, painfully shy young lady. And I remember her coming onto the sessions. And back then I was running. I was doing everything, actually, because when I set it up, it was just me and a few volunteers. And I wanted to run the programs at the beginning to make sure they worked, but to also kind of take with me on the journey everything that we're about. And I wanted to get the first-hand experience to do that. So Bethany was shy. She's quite easily influenced, which I think lots of 14-year-olds can relate to. She was getting into the wrong group, sort of feeling like she had to be a certain way to fit in with the group. But she also felt uncomfortable with that. She felt that it wasn't quite right, yet her teachers were seeing her get into the wrong groups, starting to not turn up for lessons. So that was Bethany. She then went through the three levels of our programmes, and at every single level, you saw her blossom a little bit more. So she started having the confidence to step forward when we were doing problem-solving tasks, to put her hand up and say that she thought she had the answers. We're lucky enough at lots of our bases to have access to the high ropes and the low ropes, and the high ropes are pretty scary. So you imagine a kind of a telegraph pole with a rope hanging off it, and you've got a safety harness on, but you're either told to walk along a tight rope or you have to kind of abseil down. And she was absolutely petrified. But at the end of this task, she was shining. And the idea that if I can do that, I can do anything, Emma, she really blossomed and grew. And then at the end of the programmes, she had a very firm idea in her mind that she wanted to go into law. So she decided she wanted to be some way go into law. She came with me. It was one of the best days of my life, actually. RAF 100, we got an invite to go down to Westminster Abbey and have a service there and to see the fly past. And I had to choose one of our students. I wanted to choose one of our students to come with me on that day. So she came with me and we sat at Westminster Abbey, and Meghan Markle, as she was then, was not very far away. And I remember Bethany going, oh, I was inspired by her role in Suits. That's what made me want to go into being a lawyer. So she was in front of us, and it was an amazing day. And she's gone on to follow that ambition. So even through last year and everything that's happened, she's got herself a place at university. She's actually going to be doing psychology with a law conversion at the end. So she's got that place waiting, but she's had to put it on hold because of COVID. But during that time, she's been doing two jobs. It's amazing. I phoned her. She was just walking to her car from the bank. So she said, Emma, I work at the bank. I work at the bank from 10 o'clock till 5 o'clock. And then I go home, I have dinner. I then work at a supermarket doing the kind of packing for the online shopping. And she does that from some crazy hours. I think she says, I do that from 9 o'clock till 3 o'clock in the morning. Go home and a couple of seats. But she was buzzing because she said, this means that I can save up to do my degree. And she said, amazingly, this is what the John Egging Trust has taught me. It's taught me that when things don't go to plan, there is always another way, and I am focused on what I want to do in the future. So she's just fantastic, and she will go on to become that lawyer, a solicitor. I know she will.
That must give you so much satisfaction. I mean, that's one life that you've helped turn around, but it's not one, Emma. It's 30,000 people's lives you've touched so far. And then this fantastic vision and ambition over the next decade to get up to 1 million. It's fantastic work. You must feel very proud of the team around you for being able to make this difference. It's so important, isn't it? And especially post-pandemic, when a lot of youngsters are really struggling.
And that's also the learning curve for me, right? You know, again, I've not got any business background, but I very much have learned, and brilliantly, that you take an idea, you then get the people around you to believe in you and make that idea work. Turn away from the ones that don't believe in you. You focus on the ones that do. You adapt if it doesn't work quite well, but you focus on what has worked and then you scale it up. So that was a kind of startup idea and momentum. But then quite quickly, when it works, as everyone listening to this who's been in business knows, you've then got to professionalize. You can't keep doing it by yourself. So then you've got to bring in the other people who can help you do more of what you do well. You've got to get all the systems in place. As a youth charity, obviously data protection and keeping young people safe is at the heart of what we do. So making sure that we have the systems and the policies and everything in place. And we've grown quite quickly. So the fact that we added a new area every year for the first 8 years, it really was a mind-blowing kind of trajectory of hard work and growth. But we now have a team of 20 staff and a fantastic 200 volunteers and 20 military organisations and 20 corporate partners. So without those people who believed in me at the beginning, but then continue to believe in us and continue to offer their time and their support and their financial backing, we would not be here today. So it's that thing I said at the beginning about John, the teamwork, the leadership, those are life skills. Doesn't matter what you choose to do, you've got to have those skills.
I think successful businesses are all about people as well. People are at the heart, and it's really easy to see, Emma, talking to you, why people would believe in you and back you and championing you. You had such a brilliant idea and you've realized it so well. I mean, Jet's now in its 10th year, and not just content with marking that decade, you're marking that decade with 10 epic challenges. I looked at your social media the other day and thought, oh my goodness, Emma's just run 33 miles on an ultra marathon. Tell me about the crazy challenges that you're taking on this year to mark that 10th year.
So 10 years ago, so it was literally 6 weeks after John's accident, I decided I would try road biking. I had a push bike as a kid, but John was due to compete in a coast-to-coast challenge to raise money for some charities that are close to the heart of the Red Arrows. And it was actually my brother, the day after John died, and my brother's a big mountain fell runner and he's very much into his outdoor pursuits. My brother said to me, why don't you take John's place? And I did. So I got given a bike and I trained a little bit, but this was a grueling 100 miles a day bike ride from coast to coast. But I loved it as well because I was there, I was with the whole of the Reds, I was doing something positive and I was also training, which feels good. And I loved it. So I just thought, you know, this is 10 years on. If I did that 10 years ago, I might as well set myself a challenge for this year. And one of the brilliant members of our team, our comms director, said, it's our 10th year, Emma. How about doing 10 challenges? I was like, yeah, all right, then I'll do 10 challenges. And it's all about this idea of when you push yourself out of your comfort zone, as long as you're doing it safely, it's amazing what you can achieve. And if we're asking our young people to do that, then I feel that it's really important that we model that as a team. So I am doing challenges from running, and I do love running. I've always run, but I've never run an ultra marathon. So I did that at the beginning of this year. I'm doing an open water swim in a couple of weeks' time. And again, I've never done open water swimming, but I bought my wetsuit and I've got all the gear and I've done some training. And it's such a nice feeling being outside without having a swimming pool around you. So these are also opportunities that I've never had the chance to take. And I'm putting myself in that position of putting, I guess, my head above the parapet and saying I'm going to be doing this. So I've kind of got to do it. But at the same time, I'm finding it so rewarding to learn new skills and to showcase what we do as a charity. So what else am I doing? I'm going to be doing the Great North Run, which we're able to do every year as we're affiliated with the Great North Run and are lucky enough to have some places. I'm going to be doing the London Marathon, but virtually with a few of the Jet team. I'm also going to be going caving with my brother, which is interesting because that really is a bit scary for me. Doing a triathlon. So yeah, these are all things that are peppered throughout the year, which are about raising money, pushing yourself out of your comfort zone, and that little bit of stretch, which feels a bit scary, but when you've done it, oh my goodness, you'll never forget those moments. But really importantly, as we look forward to the next decade and that ambition to reach 1 million young people, funding, as it always is so vital to Jet. So our ambition is to raise £100,000 through me doing these challenges. But also there's a John Erking Trust Jet 10 virtual relay in which we've now got over 400 people from across the country who next weekend are going to be taking on their own 10K challenge. And this is from people at RAF Cranwell who are dressing up as a camel to complete their 10K. RAF Barkston Heath, they're going to be pulling the weight of an aeroplane that they fly in team. So there's an amazing, quirky teams doing amazing things to raise money for us. So this year, I would love to be able to reach that 100,000 target as we look to scale up our programmes over the years ahead.
You also have some wonderful supporters, trustees and patrons. How did Professor Brian Cox get involved?
We just privilege, really, to have Brian on board as part of the team. I think it goes back to 2014, actually. Dunk Mason, one of our fantastic trustees, was the officer commanding the Battle of Britain Memorial flight at RAF Coningsby. So flying Spitfires and Hurricanes and getting a chance to speak to these amazing veterans who flew those aeroplanes or serviced those aeroplanes. So Dunk, I believe, met Brian when Brian came to visit and spent time with the BBMF. And at that point, Dunk was talking about JET because he'd seen our programmes. He'd sort of met some of our young people and worked with them in his role as leader of the BBMF, and said to Brian, "Brian, I'm now a trustee of this charity. This is what we do. We inspire young people to achieve without limits. And I'm really impressed with the work. Would you have a chat with Emma? Because I think she'd really like to speak to you." So Brian said yes. And I remember phoning him up. I was in London. I was still working at the British Museum. I remember in my lunch break, I'm phoning Professor Brian Cox. And it was just such, he gave me 45 minutes of his time. He listened to what we were doing. He listened to what I wanted to do. And he didn't say, "Oh gosh, that's a big ambition." He just said, "I get it. There's a real need right now to support the young people you support. Inspiration is everything." And he said, "Yes, I'd love to be a patron." I was just kind of speechless at the end of the phone. And he's been with us on the journey ever since. He's come and met our young people. He's come to our dinners. He's spoken to our young people about his journey and how, you know, he chopped and changed from a musician to becoming a scientist. And next year, our focus at JET is going to be on space. We're really privileged as well to have Air Vice Marshal Harv Smith as another one of our patrons. And Harv, as Director of Space UK, is obviously just in an amazing world at the moment, thinking about what that means for the UK and what that means for the military. So with Brian and Harv, I've got a real opportunity to open up that world for young people even more. So Brian's going to be working with us on all sorts of different spacey-themed programmes with our young people next year. So that's what I have enjoyed the most about the charity. It's been about realising that idea that John had, the idea that he and I talked about, but through these amazing people like Professor Brian Cox, but also those 200 volunteers who selflessly give their time to us because they know the power of what we do.
Do you miss the British Museum and the archaeology side of your life at all? Or are you just so immersed in this and thrilled with how it's all grown that you don't miss that side of things?
I have grown, definitely. I've changed. But a little bit of me would always love and will always love to just be surrounded by archives and objects and just having that opportunity to think deeply about objects. But then there's the same reason, Helen, because objects and their stories tell you about people. They tell you about the interactions. They tell you about moments of joy, moments of sadness. And what attracted me to working with objects and archaeology was that those stories are hidden and they're there to be found out because you can find them out. So the charity's taught me how I go from being sort of that quiet sort of researcher who's got lots of ideas and good at writing and to someone that's got lots of ideas, but now knows, I guess, how to take an idea and make it a reality. So I know that one day I will have an opportunity to dip my toe back into the heritage world. There's so much going on right now about object stories and how we unlock untold stories in a way that creates dialogue. So I'm really passionate about that. I think I'm really passionate about those untold voices and stories and bringing that back to young people, those young people who have got so much to give, but without that key to unlock that, they'll always be a bit less than they could be. And that's not right. Everyone has a right to be the best they can be. And I really believe that we're never going to be in a society where everyone is totally equal, but that doesn't stop us from trying to support those, whether it's young people who just don't get the opportunities that others do, or whether it's, you know, if you're looking at archaeology and history, maybe those voices that have been silenced more than others. So I'm talking about women's stories, or I'm talking about people from cultures where perhaps they weren't the dominant at the time, therefore their stories have been shuffled down in terms of significance. It's just about shuffling those stories up. And with our young people, it's absolutely about a mindset. And if you can support a young person to believe in themselves, they do the rest. So yeah, I think equality probably is something that is a constant strand, whether it's in the museum world with young people, you know, and everything that I do. I really do believe that there's a way that we can all be and support each other, which helps presence the untold and help celebrate the untold and help strive towards a fairer society. And I think whatever I do has got to sort of feed into that ambition in some way.
I'm sure you will get back to looking at old objects and that storytelling side of life eventually when life slows down a bit. But also you've got very young children as well. Now you're a mom and presumably you see the world through their eyes too and wanting the best for them.
Yeah, and going back to the pandemic, it is scary how the divide has got deeper, I guess, between, and I guess count myself as one of these, you know, we've not been able to go on holiday. It's not been a pleasant year. It's been really hard just trying to make sure that as a charity, we are doing the right thing constantly when we can't do the business as usual. Obviously, you've got to think about what do we conserve, but also how do we then grow when we need to grow? And that's gone through this process of really developing new offers to our programme. So we now have Jet Inspired, which is this online resource for teachers, which is fantastic. Any teacher can go on, they can download films, they can download resources. And we've worked with the fantastic Red Arrows team. We have Monty talking to camera about how he prepares to lead a successful sortie, how he supports his team to fly, how he debriefs his team. And he does it in a brilliant way. He makes those skills that he has accessible to any young person. And they're just simple messages like, if you don't get enough sleep and have breakfast, then you're not going to be able to perform. You're not going to be the best you can be. You know, don't give up. If you don't do something perfectly the first time, try again. Because we practice sorties for hours and hours and hours and we never get it right the first time. Even when we see ourselves performing, it's never perfect. And you can always learn something. So these are such incredible life skills. So these resources that we've created, it was with the idea that if young people are facing quite a tough future, the young people we work with may be the ones at home that didn't have the digital capacities to work online, three kids crowding around one phone to try and get their schoolwork done. This provides the teachers that we support with resources that help young people get beyond this hump. And it's going to be a hump that they have ahead of them to continue with that focus, which we've talked about through this interview, to stay true to who they are, but also never give up on the belief that they have got something in themselves which will lead to a great career, to great ambitions. And you look at Bethany, she certainly would not have any idea of what it is to be a lawyer had she not at 14 had, I guess, the John Egging Trust programs, which gave her that confidence and self-belief. So how many other young people are around 14 now and perhaps not going to get to that end point just because of what they're seeing ahead of them? So I'm determined through these resources and through what we want to do over the next 10 years that no young person is left out and that every young person is there now needing that little bit of help, that little bit of inspiration and self-belief, that as a charity we can work with them and through other charities as well to reach out to that 1 million by 2031.
If anyone's listening to this, Emma, feeling inspired and wanting to get on board and help, how can you get involved with the John Egging Trust?
Please check out our website, johneggingtrust.org.uk. You'll find lots of information about what we do and what we offer. We've also got Jet Inspired, which is another linked website. You can get to that through our main website. But Jet Inspired, we really want these resources to get out to as many schools as possible. They're completely free. All you need to do is sign in so we know how they're being used. So please, you know, share those resources, use those resources, feedback on them. But also if you're a corporate out there or you're an individual that might like to support, please get in touch. You can email us with your ideas. Obviously, we're always looking for corporates that expand that offer and maybe help us scale up our work or fund our work in the region. So funding is so important. We get no government support. We are all based on either our fantastic corporate supporters, grants and trusts, but we're only able to do what we do because of that swell of community support and funding that we get. And with more support like that, we can do more. So yeah, we'd love to hear from anyone who thinks they can help.
Just at the beginning, Emma, before I let you go, you said about learning to fly and it challenged you. I'm about to embark on learning to fly a small aircraft. I never thought I'd do it. And I'm assured it's all about cows getting smaller and cows getting bigger. Is it as easy as that?
Wow.
No. I'm not sure I have the mental capacity to take
Helen,
it on.
If you don't try it, you don't know. And I think it's amazing that you're trying and you might be the next Top Gun. You never know.
I know 100% that I won't, but if I ever make a solo, that'll be quite some achievement. I'm going to give it a go anyway. As you say, it's important to keep challenging yourself and pushing yourself. And I never thought that opportunity would come. So it's got to be done, hey?
That's fantastic. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
Will you come and talk to our young people about it when you've had a try?
I'll come and talk to your young people. I'll come and talk to your young people about my life in broadcasting if you want as well.
That would be amazing.
From the day the careers teacher told me that people from Grimsby in Lincolnshire don't become television presenters, so I should become a teacher. So
that would be amazing.
Very happy to do that for you. It'd be an absolute pleasure. Thank you. It's been really lovely talking to you today. I know you've got a really full on day, so I'm going to let you go. But it's been fantastic to hear more about JET. And I have no doubt at all that you will realise that ambition of touching a million people's lives by the end of the next decade. And if there's anything I can do, then you know where I am. Just shout out. It'd be a pleasure to help.
Thank you. Thank you for listening.
Well, you've been listening to Dr. Emma Egging, CEO and founder of the John Egging Trust. If you'd like to find out more about the work Emma and her team do, or get involved or make a donation, please go to their website, johneggingtrust.org.uk. They're making a real difference to thousands of young people. Download and subscribe to our podcast series at convex.podbean.com, or search The Convex Conversation on Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts, or just ask Alexa. I'll see you next week with another inspirational guest. Bye for now.